You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Elizabeth, and I will be reading to you this morning from the Lowell Sun and the Eagle Tribune, dated Thursday, July 23rd. Lab would like to thank Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. I will start with the Lowell Sun. Former LCCPS teacher pleads not guilty in child rape case. Prosecutors say victim was 14, Lynn middle schooler. By Aaron Curtis. A former Lowell Community Charter public school teacher is alleged to have had sexually abused a 14-year-old student at the Thurgood Marshall Middle School in Lynn during the 22-23 school year, where he was an eighth-grade teacher there. The Essex District Attorney's Office released the information on Wednesday, hours after the 38-year-old Taimond Tran pleaded not guilty in Essex Superior Court to charges including aggravated rape of a child by an age difference of 10 years or more, indecent assault and battery on a child 14 or over, exhibiting a child in a nude or lascivious pose, and distributing obscene matter to a minor. After the pleas were entered, Essex Assistant District Attorney Kate Berrigan McDougall outlined a series of conditions for Tran's release on personal recognizance. Judge John Frazier ordered Tran to remain on a GPS monitor and under 24/7 house arrest, with exceptions for emergency medical needs, court appearances, and attorney visits. Tran must stay in Massachusetts and reside at a home on Perrin Street in Attleboro. He is also subject to random searches of electronic devices, must have no contact with any victim or witnesses, and is prohibited from possessing child sexual abuse material. When Frazier asked Tran if he would comply with the conditions, Tran quietly responded, "Yes, sir." Following the roughly 3-minute hearing, Tran left the courtroom with two family members and his attorney, Megan Elise Stanley. Tran declined comment through Stanley, who said that they would not be commenting on the case at this time. A family, including a child who had been seated in the courtroom gallery and exited shortly after the arraignment, declined to comment as they were escorted to an elevator by a court employee. Because of the sensitive nature of the charges, the police incident report in the case has been impounded. LCCPS previously notified families in a June letter that Tran, who worked as a middle school technology teacher, had been arraigned in Lynn District Court and was immediately suspended, then terminated the same day administrators learned of the allegations. The school stressed that the charges stem from alleged conduct in Lynn in 2022 before Tran was hired in Lowell and that no LCCPS students were involved. In a statement issued through its communications firm, Slowey McManus, LCCPS said it cooperated with law enforcement and would continue to monitor the case, adding that safety and well-being and trust of the students and families remain our highest priorities. In 2022, Amazon named Tran one of its Amazon Future Engineer Teachers of the Year while he was teaching at Thurgood Marshall, selecting him as one of the top dynamic teachers nationwide, honored for promoting diversity and inclusion in computer science and robotics. Tran, who court records lists as living on 2nd Street in Hudson, New Hampshire, at the time of the arrest, is scheduled to return to Essex Superior Court for a pretrial conference on August 26th. Budget chief slams brakes on Healey's education funding push. This is by Sam Drysdale, State House News Service, Boston. House Ways and Means Chair Aaron Michaelowitz has some serious concerns about the governor's election year proposal to spend $100 million on public schools before they've even collected the revenue to support it. The ink hasn't dried yet on the actual fiscal year 2027 budget, so I think we'd like to see that implemented first, the House budget chief said. There's a lot of concerns related to raising that Chapter 70 number further. May further complicate things for future budgets. Governor Mara Healey filed a $100 million fiscal 2027 supplemental budget last week, 2 weeks after the first day of the fiscal year and 6 days after she signed the budget. Lawmakers agreed to invest $7.66 billion in public education aid, completing the final year of the Student Opportunity Act, a 4% or $300 million increase over fiscal 2026. They also agreed to review the contentious school funding formula with a revival of the Foundation Budget Review Commission. Healey's plan would inject another $100 million into public schools on a per pupil basis, a proposal she announced at a press conference flanked by education, local, and union leaders during a year when she is running for re-election. The strain on municipal budgets has been among the largest challenges this session and a repeated campaign theme. We certainly are going to talk with the administration on this and talk with members of the House, Michaelowitz said. But I do think we have some serious concern related to changing that number so quickly, so fast, right after the budget has been signed. The governor's supplemental budget filing letter says the funding would come from excess unbudgeted fair share surtax revenue in FY27. For the past few years, the legislature and the governor had used conservative estimates when budgeting education and transportation spending. From a 4.5% surtax on high earners, as they often say, is a volatile revenue source, then spent the excess revenue from the previous year, each spring, after total collections are known. Healey is proposing to dedicate excess tax collections to the supplemental budget before they have been gathered. Asked about this, a spokesperson for the Executive Office of Administration and Finance said the bill proposes to use fair share collected above the $2.7 billion used in the budget. We don't have an updated projection at the time for the FY27, but we know we collected over $3 billion in FY25, and through May 2026, we had already collected $3.1 billion in FY26. Michaelowitz said the administration told him in advance that they planned to file the bill, so I mean, I wouldn't call it a surprise, he said. But I do think moving that quickly is certainly unprecedented, Michaelowitz said. I don't remember supplemental budget being filed a week after the budget's been signed in the past. Healey surrounded herself with supporters of her proposal when she announced a major new investment we're making in our schools, our students, and our communities. During the press conference in the State House on July 15th, cities and towns across Massachusetts are facing serious financing challenges, Healey said, asserting schools are making impossible choices like layoffs, service and program cuts, and reductions to counseling and extracurricular activities for students. And the final article on the front page of today's Lowell Sun, you have to share your culture. Artists, food vendors gear up for the 39th Lowell Folk Festival. This is by Peter Currier. Peniel Guerrera has spent his life promoting Haitian culture through the beat of a drum and traditional dances from his home country. He was born in 1971 in St. Marc, a small town in Haiti, where Guerrera grew up around the religion and culture of Haitian voodoo, of which percussion, singing, and dancing are traditional tenets. Guerrera has since moved to the United States, become a citizen, and now runs two companies out of New York City, Tambula de Haiti and Creole Bode. In 2025, he was the recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Heritage Fellowship, stemming from his lifelong mission of passing along the knowledge of Haitian voodoo, drumming, and dance traditions. Guerrera has brought that tradition all over the country and the world, but this weekend he will perform at the Lowell Folk Festival for the very first time. "This is what we do. You have to go and you have to share your culture," Guerrera said in a phone call with the Sun Tuesday afternoon. It will be the 39th annual iteration of the iconic festival in Lowell, which got its start in 1987 as the National Folk Festival before rebranding to be named after its home city in 1990. Guerrera will have the multiple performances throughout the weekend, starting at 1 p.m. Saturday at Boarding House Park Stage and again on Sunday with a 3 p.m. show at the Richard K. and Nancy L. Donahue Stage at St. Anne's, followed by a 5 p.m. performance at the Saab Family Foundation Stage on Market Street. Guerrera will be one of the many performances found within the free festival in Lowell this weekend, with each one bringing their unique cultures from the world over to the five stages spread across the festival grounds. Bluegrass, polka, Tuvan, throat singing, traditional Sicilian music, African American a cappella gospel, and many more are the genres that can be found. The festivities run Friday evening to Sunday evening, starting at 6:15 Friday with the annual parade of flags through downtown to Boarding House Park, which will be led by the Middlesex County Volunteers, Fife and Drums. The parade will be followed by a kickoff ceremony, and the first musical act will begin in short order with Puerto Rican Curtista Fabiola Mendez taking the Boarding House Park stage at 7, and other artists performing at the Rockland Trust Bank Dance Pavilion on Arcan Drive soon after. The last act on Friday is scheduled to end at 10:15, and things will get started right back up again at noon on Saturday, with performances at all five stages until the final act concludes at 10 p.m. Festivities will start up again on Sunday at noon, and the final act of the festival scheduled to end at 6 p.m. Among those performers kicking off the Saturday festivities at 12:30 p.m. at the Rockland Trust Bank Pavilion will be Eastern Sound Orchestra, a polka group based in New Hampshire, which has been performing together for 50 years. John Sobczak is the founding member of the group, and he told The Sun Friday that this will be the third time performing at the Lowell Folk Festival, though they do perform at the Dom Polski at Lowell at least once a year. "Polka music is happy music. We'd like to get everybody up and dancing, and we are going to do just that at the festival," said Sobczak. "Especially today," he said, "generally we need some happiness in the world. We don't do it for the money. We do it for the people and their enjoyment." Sobczak urged anyone coming to the show to join in and sing along, which he said happens also to be the title of their opening number. Eastern Sound Orchestra will have a second show Saturday at the Market Street stage at 3:20 and then again on Sunday at the Rockland Trust Dance Pavilion at 2:35. The Lowell Folk Festival serves as the venue for sharing cultures, not just through music, but also famously through food. Each year, local organizations sell food representatives of their various cultures throughout the festival grounds. Dishes from Nigeria, the Philippines, Brazil, Laos, and many other countries and cultures will be served, with the proceeds from the food sales serving as a major annual fundraiser for each organization. Among the offerings will be Greek food, which will be served by Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church at JFK Plaza and the Associated Hellenic American Academy at Boarding House Park. Theodora Strathopoulos told The Sun Monday that the church has been participating in the festival for as long as the festival has existed, while the Hellenic American Academy, which is under the umbrella of the church, joined them with their own booth more than 20 years ago. Strathopoulos described the church's menu, which will be featured chicken and lamb gyros, souvlaki, kebabs, Greek salad, spinach, baklava, and kolakia, which is a braided butter cookie. We're basically presenting our most recognizable and popular dishes, said Strathopoulos. The money raised from the church's food sales at the festival benefits the parish itself as well as the ministries the parish supports. For the Academy, PTA President Georgia Aganis said the funds raised benefit the students, particularly by paying for some of the extracurricular activities. Field trips, enrichment, sports programs, all that money goes to those things, said Aganis. The Hellenic American Academy will have a similar menu to the church, with gyros, souvlaki, meat skewers, and baklava, but it will also include the popular baklava sundae, Aganis said, which will feature Greek pastry with vanilla ice cream, hot fudge, and whipped cream. Over on Market Street, one can taste the Armenian food from the Armenian Relief Society, which Saucy Jeknavorian said has been the best-selling at the festival for just about the entire run. One thing we can brag about is Armenian Losh Kebab, an Armenian-style hamburger we serve every year, and people love it, Jeknavorian said in a phone call Tuesday. The Losh Kebab can also be eaten as a dinner plate. Alongside it can try the spinach pita, stuffed grape leaves, which is an American meat pie. The organization also sells a number of bakery items such as borma, gadaif, paklava, and Armenian coffee rolls. With the funds they raised, Jeknavorian said the Armenian Relief Society donated to the local charities like Merrimack Valley Food Bank, local homeless shelters, Salvation Army, Dwelling House of Hope, Alternative House, and Youth Camp in the U.S. and Armenia. And if there is anything left over, we try and sponsor a few orphans in Armenia, said Jeknavorian, citing the impact of the Armenian population from the recent war in the country fought against neighboring Azerbaijan. Organizing the festival every year is a massive effort requiring a number of people to make it happen. At the top of it all is the Lowell Festival Foundation Executive Director Lee Vasilis, who described the whirlwind effort to make it all happen every year in a July 16th call with The Sun. I was up until 2 a.m. doing banners yesterday, said Vasilis. It's one of those things where everything comes together at the last minute. As a lead organizer, Valesius said she seldom gets time to enjoy many performances the festival hosts, but she does make sure to take breaks and at least enjoy some of the food. She couldn't pick a favorite dish at the festival, as it would be like choosing a favorite child, but she said there are some dishes she goes out of her way to get every year. If I don't get my Armenian burger on a pita, I will hysterically sob, Valesius said with a laugh. As she walks the festival grounds each year, she said some of the women running the food tents go out of their way to make sure she is eaten as she passes them. These are the women that in many cases I don't actually remember their names, but they are just the sweetest people on the planet, said Valesius. As with any largely outdoor event, watching the weather becomes more important in the lead-up through the festival goes on, rain or shine. Knock on wood that it is going to be really great weather. Whether there is good weather, it is just such a great festival. It is so much fun, it doesn't even matter who the bands are. It's always cool. Come see Super Chicken make cool guitars out of hubcaps. Come see Alash do Alash what Alash does, says Valesius, referring to the Tuvan throat singing group. The festival costs about $1 million to run each year. The majority of that is typically raised through donations, many of which are given through the festival to the Bucket Brigade volunteers who will be walking the festival grounds. A small portion of the funding comes from the $20,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Arts each year. Last year, Valesius was told before the festival that the grant was being pulled amid a slew of federal funding cuts by the Trump administration, but it was reinstated after the festival had taken place. This year, Valesius said the grant money was received without any hiccups. The full performance schedule and food menus can be viewed at lowellfolkfestival.org. Check out the Sun's Festival special section in Thursday's edition. And that's the front page of today's Lowell Sun. Moving to the inside local news page, man set apartment fire in suicide that killed neighbor. Man who started blaze previously accused of arson. This is by Aaron Curtis, Nashua, New Hampshire. Authorities believe an 80-year-old man who had a prior history of arson allegations intended to take his own life when he ignited a fire inside his Orange Street apartment early Tuesday morning. Instead, investigators say the blaze also caused the death of one of his neighbors. The fire set by Gerald Guttenkast at 19 Orange Street spread beyond his apartment and through the rest of the building, killing both Guttenkast and 66-year-old Scott Thomas. According to Attorney General John Fumella's offices, autopsies determined both men died from smoke inhalation. Authorities said firefighters and police were first called to 19 Orange Street shortly before 3:30 a.m. Tuesday for a reported fire in a multi-unit building. Eight residents escaped the blaze. First responders later pulled Thomas from his apartment and rushed him to Southern New Hampshire Medical Center in Nashua, where he was pronounced dead. Gerald Guttenkast was found deceased in his upstairs unit. In a press release about the fire issued late Tuesday afternoon, Fumella's office said a suspicious death investigation was underway. The release noted that Guttenkast had previously been charged in 2019 in Hudson, New Hampshire, with arson and threats of violence. Court proceedings at the time included competency evaluations, and the charges were ultimately dismissed after Guttenkast was found not competent to stand trial and not restorable. Authorities said in a Wednesday press release that the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner conducted autopsies on both men and found that Guten Kunst died from smoke and inhalation and that his manner of death was suicide. Thomas also died from smoke inhalation and his manner of death was ruled homicide. Officials noted that while the investigation into the origin and cause of the fire remains ongoing, information available at this time does not enable law enforcement investigators to make some preliminary conclusions. According to the release, investigators believe that shortly after 3 a.m. Tuesday, Guten Kunst locked the door to his apartment and intentionally ignited a fire inside. He did not attempt to escape. Investigators have reviewed communications sent by Mr. Guten Kunst at the time of the fire indicated his intent to commit self-harm, and fire patterns inside the apartment indicated the fire was set intentionally, the release states. The fire spread beyond Guten Kunst's apartment and through the rest of the building, causing Thomas to inhale smoke that ultimately killed him. There is no indication that at this time that Mr. Guten Kunst specifically intended to harm Mr. Thomas by his act, the release continues. Given these facts, the Attorney General has preliminarily concluded that Gerald Guten Kunst intentionally committed an act of arson inside his apartment in an act of self-harm, and that this act recklessly caused the death of Scott Thomas under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life, the release states. Fire Marshal Sean Toomey said in the press release that the incident underscores that arson is not a victimless crime, noting that any intentionally set fires puts in motion a series of events that significantly jeopardizes the safety of both the public and the first responders. Using National Fire Protection Association data, Toomey said intentionally set fires in the U.S. can cause more than 400 deaths, 1,300 injuries, and $1.3 billion in direct property damage annually. Individuals in an emotional distress or contemplating suicide are urged to seek assistance. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline are available 24/7, providing free and confidential support. Contact the Lifeline by texting 988 or visiting 988lifeline.org for an online chat. A five-minute read. Howell joins Greater Boston Food Bank as CEO. The Greater Boston Food Bank selected Kyle Howell as its new CEO, who will succeed Catherine D'Amato on October 1st. Howell has over two decades of leadership experience and currently serves as CEO at Community Teamwork in Lowell, an organization with over 650 employees and $220 million budget that serves more than 65,000 individuals and families annually. Under his leadership, CTI runs the anti-poverty program for the region and works alongside numerous Greater Boston Food Bank agencies and coalition partners. Kyle possesses both the practical experience of leading a large, complex human service organization and a legacy of lifting up those in need, critical assets for this important role. GBFB Board of Directors Chair Ted Truscott said Kyle understands how economic instability contributes to hunger and has proven track record and success navigating and shaping federal and state policies to improve lives. He will bring heart, experience, and a fresh perspective to our work. GBFB is the largest hunger relief organization in New England and one of the largest food banks in the country. For more information, visit gbfb.org. Movie time. Enjoy an afternoon screening of the R-rated drama Is This Thing On? Friday, July 24th in the meeting room of the Tewksbury Public Library, 300 Chandler Street. As their marriage unravels, Alex faces middle age and divorce, seeking new purpose in the New York comedy scene. Meanwhile, His wife, Tess, confronts sacrifices made for their family, forcing them to navigate co-parenting identities. Starring Will Arnett, Laura Dern, and Bradley Cooper, doors will open at 1:30 p.m. for the 2-4 showing. Candy and water will be served, and a dollar donation is suggested. The library movie events are sponsored by the Friends of the Library and Tewksbury Lions Club. Registration is required, and spots are filling up. And for information, call 978-640-4490. Billerica Community Farmers Market, Billerica, the Billerica Community Farmers Market, continues its 2026 season at 3 p.m. on Monday, July 27th at the newly renovated Pinehurst Park, 793 Boston Road. The market will be open Mondays from 3 to 7 p.m. or dusk through September 28th. Recognized as the number one farmers market in Massachusetts by American Farmland Trust, America Farmers Market Celebration for four consecutive years, 2022 to 2025. BCFM brings together local farms, prepared foods, artisans, crafters, food trucks, demonstrations, and live entertainment. BCFM supports local agriculture by providing farmers and producers with a direct outlet for their goods, while also promoting healthy eating and community connection. To improve access for the neighboring food insecurity, BCFM accepts SNAP and EBT, SunBucks EBT. Thanks to the support of the Town of Billerica Community Grant, corporate sponsors, and community donations, the market offers matching funds up to $25 per account each week while funds last. For more information, visit BillericaCommunityFarmersMarket.org. Save the date, the Southeast Asian Water Festival. The Lowell Southeast Asian Water Festival takes place on Saturday, August 15th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. along the Lowell Heritage State Park, 160 Pawtucket Boulevard. The day features food, boat races down the Merrimack River, and cultural performances and local vendors. The Lowell National Park will offer a free riverboat ride. The festival is dedicated to the preservation, protection, and sharing of cultural heritages of Southeast Asian Americans in Greater Lowell. For information, visit lsawaterfestival.org. And that's the 5-minute read in today's news. Man accused of stealing equipment from business. Kubota tractor recovered. Mower expected to be found soon. Police told to hold public meeting. This is by Aaron Curtis, Littleton. An Acton man is accused of breaking into a Littleton commercial property twice in a week and stealing a Kubota tractor and Gravely lawn mower worth a combined $75,000. The Littleton Police Department identified Gary Hamill, 36, as a suspect in the two break-ins at Nagog Hill business. Police said someone forced their way into the property on July 13th and stole a Gravely mower valued at about $5,000. 5 days later on Saturday, officers conducted a proactive patrol, found the door damaged again, and this time a Kubota tractor worth about $70,000 was missing. After an investigation by the Littleton detectives and officers working with the Acton police identified Hamill as a suspect, police obtained an arrest warrant from the Ayer District Court on Monday. Officers from Littleton, Acton, Pepperell, and Leominster located Hamill in Leominster the next morning and arrested him at about 7 a.m. Police said in a press release on Tuesday that the Kubota tractor has been recovered and the investigation expected to investigators expect to recover the gravely mower within days. The department said it is also investigating several other break-ins reported over the past 2 months. Patrols have been increased in the areas of George Street, Laura Street, Christina Street, Foster Street, Great Road, and Edsel Road, which remain under active investigation. The Littleton Police will hold a public meeting at 5:30 p.m. Thursday at the Littleton Council on Aging at 33 Shattuck Street to update residents and answer questions about the investigation and to share safety recommendations. Community members who cannot attend but have information or concerns are encouraged to call the Littleton Police at 978-540-2300. Police added that anyone who witnesses suspicious activity should contact police immediately. The Littleton Police Department is committed to keeping the community informed and involved, and we want to share information and some basic safety measures that community members can take to help us and protect themselves, said Littleton Police Chief Douglas Landry said in a release. I want to commend the officers and the detectives involved in all of our ongoing investigations, and I look forward to engaging with the community members. Hamill was arraigned on Tuesday in Ayer District Court and held on $1,000 cash bail. He was scheduled to return to court on a pretrial conference on August 13th. His attorney, James Tabner, was not available for comment. GLCF names O'Hearn Director of Arts Initiative. Appointment reflects program growth following success of Arts Elevate pilot. This is Lowell. The Greater Lowell Community Foundation announced the appointment of Jess O'Hearn as Director of the Arts Initiative in this role. O'Hearn will provide operational leadership for Arts Elevate, GLCF's embedded community artist program. The Mosaic Lowell and Mosaic Lowell, GLCF's initiative supporting Greater Lowell creative economy. O'Hearn brings deep regional roots and a proven track record of connecting artists with Greater Lowell communities. As founding director of Mosaic Lowell, she has built programming partnerships and professional development opportunities that have strengthened the region's art ecosystem over multiple years. Her expanded portfolio reflects GLCF's commitment to integrating its arts initiatives under unified and experienced leadership. The appointment advances a core priority of GLCF's 2025-2028 strategic plan, the advancement and sustainability of regional arts infrastructure by consolidating Arts Elevate and Mosaic Lowell under dedicated and unified leadership. GLCF is building a lasting organizational capacity needed to sustain and grow arts and culture programming across the region. Jess brings exactly the combination of community relationships and operational depth that Arts Elevate needs as it moves into the next phase, said GLCF President and CEO Jay Linehan. Her leadership of Mosaic Lowell was demonstrated what it looks like to build trust and sustainability with Greater Lowell arts community, and we are confident she will bring the same commitment to Arts Elevate. In a moment when many organizations are navigating uncertainty, the Greater Lowell Community Foundation is making a powerful statement about the value of arts and culture to our communities, said O'Hearn. As an anchor institution for the region, GLCF's continued investment affirms that arts are fundamental to economic development, individual and community well-being, and the vibrant, connected communities we all want to call home. The appointment follows a milestone year for Arts Elevate. The program's fall 2025 pilot embedded four professional artists within youth-serving nonprofit organizations across Lowell, and a May 2026 showcase at the Chelmsford Center for the Arts brought together artists, partners, community members, and funders to celebrate program outcomes. When people create entrusted community spaces with artists who truly see them, transformation follows, said Jennifer Aradia, Vice President of Marketing Programs and Strategy and founder of Arts Elevate. The pilot showed us that the model works. What we are building now is a solid infrastructure to scale that impact. Aradia will retain strategic oversight of Arts Elevate. The Director of Arts Initiative Structure houses both Arts Elevate and Mosaic Lowell within GLCF's program portfolio. Alongside the appointment, GLCF has named Laura Scott Scarlett Tavares to the role of program manager, supporting both Arts Elevate and Mosaic Lowell. GLCF will continue to expand the team over the summer to meet the increased scope of combined programming. Arts Elevate expansion roadmap includes grant opportunities in 2026, an embedded artist support grant, additional arts equity grants, followed by pilot programs serving veterans and seniors in future years. And that's the entire reading of the local page in the Lowell Sun. Editorial, over to the editorial page. It's time to enjoy Lowell's signature summer festival. The 39th edition of the Lowell Folk Festival returns this weekend with a tantalizing menu of music, food, crafts, and other attractions. Preparation for this annual mega event began literally a few days after the previous folk festival concluded. The region's signature cultural event since 1987, organizers annually expect to welcome as many as 150,000 visitors to the three-day affair at the various Lowell venues, which begins Friday night with traditional parade of flags from City Hall to Boarding House Park beginning at 6:15 p.m. This year's festival becomes part of Lowell's bicentennial celebration. This admittance-free festival, the longest-running event of its kind in the United States, will feature a cross-section of musical performers and food vendors. Nearly all the downtown will be closed to vehicle traffic to create a walkable festival experience, including numerous arts, family exhibits, and dance tents. While the music may be the folk festival main attractions, the ethnic cuisine from around the world rates close second. Festival goers' palates will be treated to sumptuous variety from A, Armenian to V, Vietnamese, and virtually everything in between, including Brazilian, Burmese, Cameroonian, Filipino, Greek, Hispanic, Laotian, Liberian, Middle East, mixed African, Portuguese, Salvadoran, and, of course, Southeast Asian fare. Every folk festival global food vendor represents a nonprofit organization of many of local. And all the profits from the food goes directly back to supporting these nonprofits, churches, schools, and community groups and their mission. These dishes are not only delicious, but eco-friendly as well. All food gets served on paper plates with biodegradable utensils. And though the fest doesn't charge admission, you'll need cash or a card for food and beverage purchases. After disposing of all the plates and utensils, director Brad Bootenheiser and his Lowell litter crew will sort things out literally. Last year, they diverted more than 50% of the trash from the landfill and vowed to improve on that percentage this year. Not be outdone, the lineup of musical acts spans the gamut of styles and tastes, including but not limited to Alash, Tuvan Throat Singing, Authentic American Bluegrass, Dat Mighty Nine featuring Big Chief Romeo, Mardi Gras, Indian Music, Eastern Sound Orchestra, a Polish polka, Gino De La Russa and French Rockin' Boogie Zadeco, John Doyle and Friends Irish, Kamala Gunjal and Amy, can't pronounce that, Southern Indian centaur and tabla, Melissa Copper and Emil Gimbel classic country, Middlesex country volunteer fife and drums, and the Northern Kentucky Brotherhood African American a cappella gospel. The Discovery Museum, which made its folk festival debut last year, partnering with Discovery Lowell Play Space in a dedicated area at the corner of Merrimack and Central Streets, returns this year. This year, downtown businesses both in and around festival grounds could apply for license to coincide with the three-day event. The Hive Public Market, Mox Running and Fitness Center, the restaurant Fork, One Urban Tribe, Cafe Ellipse, and the Merrimack Textile Company and others applied for sidewalk permits for the folk festival that will extend through October. Restaurants including Tremonte Pizzeria, Cobblestones, and the Worthen House applied for special events permits for amplified outdoor public entertainment, special one-day licenses to sell and dispense malt beverages and wines, permits for expanded sidewalk / parking lot seating, all of which adds to the already robust variety of entertainment and food options. Weather-wise, it appears festival goers will experience ideal midsummer conditions with sunny skies and temperatures in low to mid-80s all 3 days. Sunblock, some portable chairs, a wide-brim hat, and an unobtrusive sun umbrella should be on your festival gear list. Folk festival parking is available throughout the city. All city parking garages will be open in addition to special event rate parking available on specific streets and regular rates in place further away from the festival venues. Parking meters will be in effect from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Friday and Saturday with special on-street rates on specific streets. Most on-street parking is limited to 2 hours, so park in a garage if you plan on staying longer. Visit the Folk Festival website for a detailed description of parking options. While there's no admission charge, it takes considerable amount of effort and money to host the event on this magnitude. The Folk Festival incurred a not inconsequential loss last year, which it would rather not repeat. Folk Festival Executive Director Lee Velisius previously said that if everyone who attended that festival just gave $10, it would have covered the cost of producing the event. That's why showing your appreciation by generously donating to the Bucket Brigade volunteers circulating through festival grounds takes an added importance. There's still time to enlist in these critical, important corps of volunteers. To sign up for the Bucket Brigade or contact Lowell Chamber of Commerce President Daniel McFadden at dmcmcfadden@greaterlowellchamber.org to secure your shift. So we encourage those of all ages to descend on downtown Lowell this weekend and experiences the annual signature summer event. Coming up on the midpoint of this morning's reading, you are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. We'd like to thank UMass Lowell's UML FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Please stay tuned. I'll be back to continue the reading of the local papers. Thank you for listening. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank WUML at UMass Lowell for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. This is Elizabeth. I will continue reading today this from the Eagle Tribune, dated July 23rd, Thursday. And I'm going to be reading to you from the Eagle Tribune. Who doesn't love to be surrounded by cool art? The Winged Rabbit A Whimsical World of Treasured Creation by Stacy Marcus Haverhill. Editor Arthur Brisbane perfectly summed up the circuitous path that an important chance travels in this way. Opportunity comes like a snail, and once it's past you, it changes into a fleet rabbit and is gone. The winged rabbit owner, Patricia Bruno, knows a thing or two about hopping on the happenstance. The moniker of her enchanting gift store pays homage to her both her journey and animals to which she relates. The shop story starts in 2007 when Bruno transitioned the business she started in 1989, Positive Images Stock Photography, into the Fine Art of Photography Gallery, Positive Issues Gallery. As the venue grew and evolved, including undergoing a relocation to just a few doors down from 61 to 53 Wingate in 2012, Bruno knew she needed to rebrand to better reflect her mission. The playful rabbit logo came first, eventually inspiring the official name change to the Winged Rabbit in 2019. When I had the opportunity to move down the hall, I leaped and changed the name to something more fitting for a gallery slash gift shop. The Winged Rabbit, and added wings to the rabbit logo. Why? Perhaps above all, Bruno has always loved rabbits. I was already reading a book about rabbits and learned that when they are stressed, they get paralyzed too. To reduce stress, she recalls, when they see an opportunity, they leap forward, which paralleled with what was happening in my life at the time. Bruno has never wanted to have a run-of-the-mill gift shop. I wanted something more whimsical, she said. The process of finding unique art for the winged rabbit is organic and magical. She said Bruno has artists who come to her, and she always also discovers them. I have had the most wonderful people walk in, and I can't tell you the amount of talent there is in Haverhill and how it has blossomed through over the years. She explains, noting that the women you stand next to you in the grocery store could be home at night painting silk scarves, or a server at the coffee shop could be hand-turning wooden bowls. Bruno said she is honored to share stories of everyone from the person who is just starting out to the seasoned artist. I'm happy to create a corner for an artist to bring in 5 vases, which is a stepping stone, and I'm happy if they leave and go on to bigger and better things, she said. Many of the local artists from Haverhill included Potter Don Herrick, Prudence Magzuba, who paints on rocks, watercolorist Pixie Yates, Christine Mariah Lucia, who crafts earrings and paints scarves, illustrator and designer Megan Lynn Holcomb, and woodturner Dave Hampstead. Others are from surrounding towns, including Boxford, Amesbury, Methuen, North Andover, and Groveland, as well as Salem, New Hampshire. She also carries fair trade items from artisans around the globe. Although the shop is less than 300 square feet, it is curated with intention. I have it rigged like a ship, Bruno said, beaming. The Winged Rabbit's eclectic collection includes wall art, photography, oils, acrylics, collages, ceramics, wood, jewelry, purses, tote bags, porcelain, clothing, clocks, felt flowers, greeting cards, and 3D figurines. Throughout the years, Bruno has featured distinctive items like marionettes, lapel pins made from dominoes, and designed by city clerk Linda Catullus, and red cardinals from the Haverhill sculptor Dale Rogers, whose famous big dog stands along the highway. 8 years ago, fused glass artist Andrea Storr had a studio in Lawrence and was visiting a friend who was a jeweler on Wingate Street. She showed Bruno her work. She said she liked it, and we started from there. She has a little bit of everything. She is welcoming and accommodating. I wish there were more things on Wingate like the Winged Rabbit, Realist painter Debbie Shirley notes that Bruno has always been a super friendly in that her shop is welcoming with a healthy mix of local artists and makers along with carefully curated gift items. I was thrilled when Pat agreed to show my work, Shirley said. My studio is here in Haverhill, so I'm happy to have someone nearby to send people who are interested in seeing my work in person. I love the local focus of the shop and the vibe in general. Over the years, Pat has found homes for a wide range of my work, from note cards and tiny ornaments to prints and larger paintings. Shirley says she truly appreciates Bruno's eye for putting pieces together in her display and her intrinsic ability to help customers find just the right item for a gift or for their home. Her shop has that personal touch that is missing in so many retail stores these days. As a person, Pat is thorough and caring and a true local gem, and I am happy to not only be showing my work with her, but to be also to call her a friend. Bruno herself is a photographer. She photographs storefronts, cafes, and restaurants and prints them on sheet material. She also makes copper earrings and some other doodads. I am not a fine artist, she claims. I just fill up empty spaces with my own funky things. When people come in from out of town and ask her what Haverhill is like, she notes that if you walk around, you can tell that there are artists here and more are coming. Artists are drawn to the city's vibe, architecture, and history. As far as whether she is considering retirement, a question her friends frequently ask, she can't imagine hopping out of the Winged Rabbit anytime soon. Who doesn't love to be surrounded by cool art, she says. Bill to stop limits on child sex abuse reporting. This is by Katie Castellani, Boston, from the State House News Service. Supporters of legislation aiming to improve remedies for survivors of child sexual abuse are hopeful that increased advocacy and similar laws passed in other states will help push the bill across the finish line in Massachusetts. We're certainly hopeful, but we don't want to get survivors' hopes up because we've been disappointed in the past, said Kelly Guanti, a Justice Law Collaborative partner. But we really feel that because so many other states have made good rulings and good laws this past year, we're hoping Massachusetts, which should be a beacon for justice issues, we really hope Massachusetts finally does the right thing by survivors this year. The bill, H4539, eliminates the statute of limitation for civil suits alleging sexual abuse of a minor and for claims that someone negligently supervised an abuser or contributed to the abuse. It also gives survivors 2 years to revive claims that are prohibited under the state current statute of limitations, including those that were previously dismissed because they were filed too late. Massachusetts' current statute of limitations for child sexual abuse is 35 years after the victim turns 18. Eliminating the statute of limitations would align Massachusetts with 19 states that have already recognized the need for survivors to seek justice on their terms. Senator Joan Lovely, a Democrat from Salem, said in a 2025 press release announcing a similar bill she filed, S1169. The bill also removes certain caps on damages that survivors can receive. Current law caps damages a survivor can get from a charitable organization at $20,000 and damages for claims for medical malpractice against nonprofit healthcare providers at $100,000. What we're doing here is trying to work with the legislature to make sure that children have access to justice, and people who have been sexually assaulted have access to justice. The institutions that harbor pedophiles can't get away with it anymore, Kim Doherty, a founding partner of the Justice Collaborative, said that supporters called a peaceful protest in support of the bill July 14th. The bill, a joint committee on judiciary redraft for several bills, has been pending in the House Ways and Means Committee since September. Similar legislation to eliminate the statute of limitations cleared the Senate at the end of the last session and died in the House. Lovely, sponsor of the bill that passed last session, said she is working with Senate leadership to bring the legislation she filed this term to the floor before scheduled formal sessions and July 31st. The bill has been in Senate Ways and Means since July 2025. My colleagues who I've spoken to, better than half the Senate, are absolutely ready to go to the floor and vote in favor. So it's got a lot of support in the Senate, and I'm sure it has a lot of support in the House, and we're ready to vote in favor. Lawmakers have until July 31st to get most controversial bills into conference committees for potential action later this year, and supporters of numerous bills are pushing for votes over the next 2 weeks to keep their hopes alive. Guaganti didn't shy away from the possibility that the bill could die again this session. If we were confident that the bill was going to pass, we wouldn't have needed to be standing on the steps with our clients, she said, referring to the protest. The reality is survivors have heard promises before, and they deserve honesty about the challenges ahead. Guaganti said her hopefulness is based on a rising number of survivors, advocates, and community members backing the issue. I think it's been a really strong year in terms of survivors really coming forward, and I think that's part and parcel of the fact that they see other states doing the right thing, she said. Lovely agreed. A dozen years ago, people just didn't want to say anything. The stigma of being sexually abused, even though it's not no fault of the child, absolutely none, and then there's so much stigma to it. And Lovely, who had been open about her own experience with childhood sexual abuse, and we've been chipping away at this for a dozen years now, and we're here and we're meeting the moment. Other states have recently passed laws aiming to improve remedies for survivors. In June, Rhode Island lawmakers passed a bill opening a 2-year window for survivors to present claims that had expired, according to the Rhode Island legislature's website. The bill's passage came after Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Narana issued a report in March finding the Roman Catholic Diocese of Providence did not properly protect children from clergy sexual abuse for decades. Among the legislative recommendations included in the report was changing the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse so survivors can present claims that were previously time-barred, according to the press release issued by Narana's office. Laws amending the statute of limitation have been met with constitutional challenges and concerns in several states. Last week, Michigan's Court of Appeals ruled that a 2018 law allowing people who were sexually abused as a minor to present claims until they were 28 also applies to claims that they were active when the statute was inactive, according to reporting by the State Affair Gongwer, Michigan. In October, the New Hampshire Supreme Court ruled that the 2020 law eliminating the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse cases can't be applied retroactively, concluding that would violate the state constitution, which bans retrospective laws and grants defendants are a vested right in invoking a statute of limitations defense. Lovely did not have a comment when asked by the news service about the constitutional concerns surrounding proposals to expand the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse. Sisters recall beloved baby sister killed in Andover crash. This is by Jill Hominsinski Lawrence. A 25-year-old woman killed in a fiery highway crash was the mother of three and one of five sisters. Angelica Jelly Pizarro gave her love freely and found her greatest happiness in loving and being loved by those closest to her. Her family members wrote on a GoFundMe account for funeral and other unforeseen financial costs. Pizarro was killed on Wednesday, July 15th in Andover on Interstate 495. Four others, including three children, were injured in the 11:30 p.m. crash on the northbound side of the highway just before Interstate 93, state police said. Andover firefighters thanked Good Samaritans who stopped to help the injured that night. Two people stopped and assisted all five of the burning minivan before firefighters arrived. Police and firefighters received 911 calls for a reported car off the highway that was on fire. When firefighters arrived, they found a 2013 Chrysler Town & Country minivan that was carrying two adults and three children. A 2009 Honda Civic was also involved in the crash, police said. Police did not release the names of others injured in the crash. It's unclear if any charges will be filed. Family members said Pizarro had a bold heart and a free spirit. Her four sisters, Magdalena, Milagros, Emily, and Sarah, described Angelica as our beloved baby sister. With her tragic passing, our family is faced with unexpected funeral costs, immediate financial needs, probate court fees, and many unforeseen costs, they wrote on the GoFundMe page. Our lives have changed overnight. More than anything, we want to ensure Jelly's children are cared for and supported as they begin adjusting to their new home and reality. Pride Star Trinity ships supplies to Ukraine. This is from Lowell by Jonah Frangiosa. Dozens of boxes of emergency medical supplies are soon to be shipped from the Merrimack Valley to the front lines of a war thousands of miles away, thanks to a crew of first responders. Pride Star Trinity EMS has donated more than 20 boxes of medical equipment to the Global Disaster Relief Team, GDRT, this week. The supplies will be shipped to Ukraine to support emergency responders, healthcare providers, and humanitarian teams caring for civilians affected by the ongoing war. The shipment includes medications such as epinephrine and albuterol, along with intubation equipment, trauma supplies, airway supplies, and hemostatic dressings, Pride Star spokesperson Christopher Dick said. Employees gathered Monday at the company's Lowell headquarters to help load the supplies onto the truck. The donation is expected to leave next week before making its way overseas, Dick said. This is Pride Star's second humanitarian initiative supporting Ukraine. In 2025, the organization donated two fully equipped ambulances through U.S. Ambulances for Ukraine to replace the emergency vehicles destroyed during the conflict. The group also recently welcomed Alexander Smirnov of GDRT to the headquarters to collect the donated supplies. Smirnov has served on the front lines in Ukraine and now delivers medical supplies and humanitarian aid to communities within the war. Rather than allowing usable medical equipment to go unused, Pride Star elected to donate them to an organization capable of delivering them directly to those in need, the group wrote. It was a mixture of new, gently used, expired, and surplus supplies that was sent to Ukraine this week. This donation continues in a relationship that began with our ambulance donation several years ago, Pride Star President and CEO David Daly said. We know firsthand that reliable equipment can mean the difference between life and death. Seeing these supplies continue their mission in Ukraine is something our team is proud to support. Smirnov, who works at Community Ambulance, first learned of Pride Star's efforts during the 2025 ambulance donation. He later approached them about continuing support for Ukraine. Every box of supplies we receive means another opportunity to care for someone in need, Smirnov said. Donations from organizations like Pride Star Trinity EMS directly support the medics and volunteers working in some of the most difficult conditions imaginable. We are deeply grateful for their continued commitment to the people of Ukraine. The GDRT provides humanitarian assistance around the world by delivering medical supplies, equipment, and disaster relief to those affected by war, natural disaster, and other emergencies. PrideStar is one of New England's largest medical service providers, delivering 911 emergency response, inter-facility transportation, education, and special event medical coverage throughout Massachusetts. EMS is built on a compassion, service, and helping others during their greatest time of need. Those values don't stop at our nation's borders. We are honored to support the Global Disaster Relief Team and grateful for the courageous work Alexander and his fellow volunteers continue to perform in Ukraine. And that's the reading of the front page of today's Eagle Tribune. And now we'll move to school complex to get accessibility upgrades. This is by Angelina Barabee, Andover. The West Elementary School and Shawshing Preschool Complex will be getting some accessibility upgrades to improve safety during student drop-off. The West Elementary School Building Committee unanimously approved adding more curb cuts at the backside of the building, 58 Beacon Street, at its Tuesday meeting. The committee formally voted on the change order for the amount of $158,000 to be charged to the construction contingency to complete the accessible work. Andover Director of Facilities Janet Nicosia said part of the sidewalk will be located in the back of the property so there can be an accessible drop-off area for Shawshing Preschool portion of the shared building. There are also some heaving of the concrete that needs to be fixed. The need for improved accessibility at the back of the building followed a change in the transportation route where buses now travel around the back to access Shawshing Preschool. The buses need accessible entrance where sidewalks meets the roadway without any transition for children who have mobility challenges or maybe using mobility device so that they do not need to take a step. Superintendent Keith Taverna said the original sign had the special education vans, the original design had the special education vans dropping off students in the front of the building where curb cuts made it accessible for students in wheelchairs. School administration staff saw the volume of traffic with parent drop-offs and became concerned about the safety of kids getting on and off vans once the preschool opened its doors in September 2025. That was a year after the West Elementary School opened following an 8-year, $168 million construction project. The new school complex accommodates 1,055 children between preschool and elementary school. Taverna said the district decided to move the drop-off to the back of the building with the large buses used for the West Elementary School and its special education vans. There are curb cuts on the West Elementary side of the building, and he said curb cuts are looking to be installed within the footprint of the preschool to help drop off work more efficiently and keep all students safe. Making sure this is fully accessible facility is very important, Committee Chair Joel Blumstein said. Erin Prestilio, a civil engineer with SMMA, the architects of the elementary and the Shawshing preschool building, said the improvements will create a place for easier arrival and dismissal for Shawshing students. Different lengths of curb cuts were considered to minimize overall work and costs, she added. The length of the curb cuts in the back will accommodate two standard school buses and up to three vans. Work to install the curb cuts is expected to take 5 weeks with a push to have them installed for the start of the upcoming school year. And then we've come over to the opinion page. Their view, Mexican president sends the wrong signal. This is by the Dallas Morning News. a potential confrontation between the U.S. and Mexico is brewing. Mexico President Claudia Sheinbaum's refusal to arrest government officials indicted in the U.S. on drug trafficking charges could be a tipping point for the Trump administration. Sheinbaum should reconsider. There is a short-term cost politically within her own circle, but a long-term gain for uprooting corruption from the Mexican government. This is an opportunity, not a choice between a rock and a hard place. Sheinbaum has been building credibility with the Trump administration with increased drug enforcement cooperation, handing over dozens of accused drug traffickers to the U.S. and intensified operations, including the February killing of Nemesio Osegura Cervantes, the leader of the cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación. But a political decision to protect members of her political party could be deeply damaging. The indicted officials include Sinaloa Governor Ruben Rocha Moya, who took a leave of absence following the charges. Federal prosecutors accuse him of protecting the Sinaloa cartel, a violent criminal organization and a major supplier of fentanyl. Rocha is a close ally of former President Andres Manuel López Obrador and a member of the Sheinbaum's political party, Morena. According to ProPublica's reporting, Sheinbaum has already decided against extraditing Rocha and has accused and other accused current and former officials. Meanwhile, López Obrador has thrust himself into the debate and accused the U.S. of plotting against Morena. According to a letter published on social media, López Obrador highlights his unconditional support of Sheinbaum, but it is not hard to read between the lines. Sheinbaum insists she has not seen the evidence against Rocha, and the Mexico recently launched an investigation into the role played by U.S. authorities during the capture of Ismael Almeo Zambada in 2024. Rocha's indictment may be linked to Zambada's cooperation with U.S. authorities. There is evidence that the Justice Department is building a strong case against Rocha with a network of informants inside the Mexican government and two indicted officials who have already turned themselves in, as reported by the New York Times. Tackling corruption in the government is key to reining in powerful cartels. Rocha could be part of the larger effort from U.S. authorities. Terrence Seacole, the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, said last May that these indictments were just the start. U.S. prosecutors should continue to build this case wherever it may lead. The biggest variable in this case, however, is President Donald Trump himself. He already pardoned former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was convicted of drug trafficking charges, and his administration is cooperating with Diosdado Cabello, a top Venezuelan official indicted on drug trafficking. At the same time, the Trump administration has previously threatened to conduct unilateral strikes against drug traffickers, a red line for Mexican authorities. Sheinbaum should not test how far those political whims may go. This is simpler than it looks. Sheinbaum insists she has not seen the evidence against Rocha, and Mexico recently launched an investigation into the role played by U.S. authorities during the capture of Almeo Zambada in 2024. And then a letter to the editor. Letters to the editor. E-bikes on rail trail require caution. To the editor. The arrival of Yankee homecoming signals that Newburyport has reached peak summer season, and influx of visitors means that our parks, especially Waterfront, Market Square, and Clipper City Rail Trail, will reach maximum usage. It is noteworthy that Newburyport's 26 parks rely on just 3 full-time city employees for the year-round maintenance and upkeep. These dedicated few, along with some seasonal employees and so many volunteers, keep the parks both safe and beautiful. Unfortunately, increases in park usage are often accompanied by increases in friction between park users. In particular, the proliferation of e-motored bikes and scooters along the rail trail and the waterfront has become a concern this summer. While plenty of e-bikers ride safely and respectfully among the trail, many pedestrians, the Parks Commission has fielded several complaints about speeding e-cyclists causing dangerous situations and even collisions. With e-motored vehicles, it is far too easy for even the youngest user to twist the throttle and reach dangerous speeds. The parks opted not to issue a blanket ban on e-powered vehicles on the rail trail. We understand that for many, an e-motored bike, scooter, or chair may be the only means for someone to enjoy the rail trail. Instead, speed limit signage is clearly posted in several locations. Updated trail maps offering a comprehensive list of trails, rules, and regulations are forthcoming. There are explicit directions for dismounting and walking bikes in particularly congested sections of the rail trail, but signage can only go so far. Ultimately, personal responsibility dictates whether someone chooses to follow park rules and regulations. Just like personal responsibility dictates whether a cyclist chooses to wear a helmet, in addition, the willingness of park users to call the police and enforce park rules and regulations is a powerful deterrent against the most flagrant offenders. News stories about e-bikers riding in ways that cause significant harm to themselves and others abound. The rail trail is a recreational venue designed to be responsibly enjoyed by all. Instead, Newburyport's parks have a major impact on our quality of life. Our safe and beautiful parks, trails, boardwalks, plazas, fields, courts, and playgrounds are not only places for respite, exercise, and rejuvenation, but also shared spaces that encourage us to practice what it means to be a good neighbor and citizen. Mosquito-borne virus found in Salem. This is by Teddy Toucher, Salem, New Hampshire. Jamestown Canyon virus has been reported in the town for first time. The virus was found in a batch of mosquitoes earlier this month. Although the risk is still considered low, the finding is the first time any mosquito-borne virus has been detected in Salem within the last 5 years, according to Health Officer Brian Lockhart. The symptoms from the virus are typically relatively mild compared to the more widely known Eastern Equine Encephalitis, or EEE, and West Nile Virus, WNV. But in the most severe cases, can affect the central nervous system with potentially fatal results, Lockhart said. Since 2011, there have been 362 reported cases of Jamestown Canyon virus in humans nationally, resulting in 12 deaths, according to the Center for Disease Control. In a 2021 batch of mosquitoes in Salem tested for EEE, WNV, and EEE were also detected in 2005. Belmont is the only community in the state rated as a moderate risk, with the majority of New Hampshire not assessed due to no positive cases being reported in most municipalities so far this season, according to a state report. The virus was also recently detected in samples taken in Exeter and Fremont, according to a posting by the town of Atkinson. Atkinson, Plastow, Hampstead, and Kingston are considered to be low risk. In most cases, symptoms will be hard to differentiate from other illnesses. Common symptoms include aches, fevers, and fatigue. If it lasts more than a few days, consult your health care provider, Lockhart said. There are no vaccines for the virus, and the treatment can only address the symptoms. The virus is relatively new to the area, but has been reported nationwide as early as 1970. Most cases are found in the Northeast, Lockhart said. Unlike Triple E and WNV, Jamestown Canyon virus moves through deer rather than birds, which reduces its ability to spread across long distances. Transitions follows a similar process through with female mosquitoes picking up the virus from deer before laying eggs. To develop and lay more eggs, mosquitoes need to find another meal, which is now how the virus is transferred to humans, Lockhart said. The town begins prevention efforts in the spring through spraying wetlands wherever mosquitoes are discovered. One of the most widely used and environmentally friendly deterrents is a bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis israelensis, more commonly known as BTI. A low dosage of bacteria is enough to kill mosquitoes without harming larger animals. During the summer, the town also treats catch basins. If it can hold water for about a week or so, there is enough time for mosquitoes to breed, Lockhart said. He advises residents to wear long sleeves and pants when practical and to try and limit any stagnant water on their property. The town will continue to tap and test mosquitoes throughout the summer, and any positive cases will be reported on the town's website. And let's read today in history. July 23rd, the 1967 riots begin. On the 204th day of 2026, there are 161 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history: on July 23rd, 1967, deadly rioting erupted in Detroit as an early morning police raid on an unlicensed bar resulted in a confrontation with local residents that led to 5 days of violence and resulted in 43 deaths. Also on this date in 1903, the Ford Motor Company sold its first car, a Model A, for $850. In 1958, Queen Elizabeth II named the first woman to peerage in the House of Lords. In 1982, actor Victor Morrow and two child actors, 7-year-old Micah Din Lee and 6-year-old Renee Yi Chen, were killed in a helicopter crash on them filming a Vietnam War scene for Twilight Zone, the movie. Director John Landis and four associates were later acquitted of manslaughter charges. In 1983, Air Canada Boeing 767 ran out of jet fuel while flying from Montreal to Edmonton. The pilots were able to glide the jetliner to a safe landing in Gimli, Manitoba. The near disaster occurred because the fuel had been erroneously measured in pounds instead of kilograms, at a time when Canada was converting to the metric system. In 1990, George H.W. Bush announced his choice of Judge David Souter of New Hampshire to succeed retiring Justice William J. Brennan of the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1996, the Atlanta Olympics, Kerry Strug made a heroic final vault despite torn ligaments in her left ankle to help secure the women's gymnastics squad's first ever Olympic team gold medal. In 1997, the search for Andrew Cunanan, the suspected killer of designer Gianni Versace and others, ended as police found his body on a houseboat in Miami Beach of an apparent suicide. In 1999, Eileen Collins became the first woman to command the U.S. space flight as the Shuttle Columbia blasted off to deploy the world's most powerful X-ray telescope, the Chandra X-ray Observatory. In 2003, Massachusetts Attorney General issued a report saying clergy members and others in the Boston Archdiocese had probably sexually abused more than 1,000 people over a period of 6 decades. In 2006, Tiger Woods became the first player since Tom Watson in 1982-83 to win consecutive British Open titles. In 2011, singer Amy Winehouse, 27, was found dead in her London apartment from an accidental alcohol poisoning. In 2012, Penn State's football coach was all but leveled by penalties for his handling of the Jerry Sandusky child sex abuse scandal as the NCAA imposed an unprecedented $60 million fine, a four-year ban from postseason play, and a cut in the number of football scholarships the school could award. In 2019, Boris Johnson won the contest to lead Britain's governing Conservative Party. Johnson became the country's prime minister the following day. 2021, Cleveland's Major League Baseball team, known as the Indians since 1915, announced that it would get a new name, the Guardians, at the end of 2021 season. The change came amid a push for institutions and teams to drop logos and names that were considered racist. And today's birthdays, retired Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy is 90, actor Ronnie Cox is 88, rock singer David Essex is 79, actor Woody Harrelson is 65, rock musician Martin Gore, Depeche Mode is 65, actor director Eric LaSalle is 64, rock musician Slash is 61, Basketball Hall of Famer Gary Payton is 58. Model actor Stephanie Seymour is 58. Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia is 57. Actor Charisma Carpenter is 56. Singer Alison Krauss is 59. R&B singer Dalvin DeGreat, or Joe Deci, is 55. Comedian Marlon Wayans is 54. Actor Catherine Hahn is 53. Actor Stephanie March is 52. R&B singer Michelle Williams is 47. Actor Paul Wesley is 44. And actor Daniel Radcliffe is 37. Thank you for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call us at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 631-359-9069 or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at lowellassociationfortheblind.org. This has been Elizabeth. It has been my pleasure reading for you. Have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow to continue the reading of local news. Have a great day. Bye-bye.